Welcome back to another episode of Health Feeding for Humanity's podcast series, Voices of the Victims. In this episode, Jody and I have a conversation with Scott Shera, who tragically lost his beautiful daughter, Grace, last year. This is such a sad story, and I can't even begin to tell you how incredible of a man this guy is. He has done so much to share his daughter's story and to get this information out there to all of you. I'm going to go ahead and leave a link in the description below. He has created a website with a wealth of information, and I'm just amazed at how much dedication and time he has put into all of this. He is creating billboard campaigns and holding protests outside the hospital that murdered his daughter. And I'm just in awe of everything that he's doing. If there's anyone out there you feel who might benefit from watching this, we ask to please share it. Now let's take a look and hear what Scott has to say about everything that has happened regarding his daughter Grace's passing and everything that he's continuing to do in her honor. Let's take a look. Thank you so much, Scott, for joining Jody and I on this episode today. It's such a pleasure and honor to have you here representing your beautiful daughter, Grace, and sharing her story with the world. This is such a tragic, tragic story. And I don't know if I'm going to be able to keep it together during this one, honestly, because I have read up on some of what has happened. And we'd love for you to tell our listeners at home about Grace and how all of this really started for you. If you can go into the story, where you guys were with COVID, maybe I guess the beginning for you and for Grace.
Well, I'll go all the way back to the beginning, which is when Grace was born. So, so we'll just start with that. So my wife and I decided to have another child after a long time. We were 39 years old and we decided to let God lead in that department. And he blessed us with an unbelievable gift. And we named her Grace after God's grace. No parent should be blessed like we were. I mean, we had an angel walking around with us on loan from God for 19 years. She was my best buddy. She was a wonderful, wonderful kid. She just loved unconditionally. I mean, the stories, you know, I could spend the entire time just talking about her, but you know, on a level that people could get to know her. If you'll see a lot of pictures and videos on Grace's website, but my lovely wife taught her how to read and write. We homeschooled Grace. So I did the things dads do. I taught her how to drive a car when she didn't have a license. and she did great. She rode a horse. She played violin at my daughter Jessica's wedding. So you just processed that. She had Down syndrome, and Down syndrome kids, you know, a lot of people have a stereotype, but I mean, Grace broke all the molds. There was nothing she couldn't do. And on top of that, she, maybe the, you know, the most fun thing about her for me is she inherited my sense of humor. And so she was a constant joy with her sense of humor. One time she went deer hunting with me so she could shoot a rifle, and we were sitting in the deer stand and she said, "Dad, I have a joke for you." And you just got to consider, this is a Down syndrome child made up her own joke. I said, "What's your joke, Grace?" And she said, "Where do bees go to the bathroom?" I said, "I don't know. Where do they go to the bathroom?" And she said, "The BP station." She was a laugh a minute. You know, she was just a great kid. It is. I miss her terribly. One of the interviews asked, you know, about all these, this investment of time and everything I'm doing. I mean, this is a snap when you had a daughter like Grace. You know, this has become a full-time job getting this word out. And, but, you know, when you have a daughter like her, it's not a chore to do it. So then you asked about, how did we get there? So on September 28th, Grace had a cold, and we had all the COVID materials at home. We were on the frontline doctor's protocol. We had everything, including ivermectin, at the house. So Grace was on vitamins and things beforehand, but the actual protocol for COVID, we started on September 28th, as soon as she got a cold, is we just assumed as soon as you get a sniffle, just assume it's COVID. If it's not, it doesn't hurt you. And then October 1st, we got a home test to test her because we were planning on going to a wedding. And we just thought, well, we better not go to the wedding if it is in fact COVID. She tested positive. Again, we didn't think anything of it. October 6th came along. Her oxygen saturation level was below 90. We couldn't get her above 90. And so that led to a trip to the urgent care, which then they did blood work. And ultimately, that led to a trip to the emergency room because the blood work showed that she had a high D dimer, which is a blood chemistry parameter that shows a propensity to clots. So in the emergency room, they did a CT scan. It came back negative. As we found out, this is fairly significant because people would wonder, why did we end up in the hospital when we were on the frontline doctor's protocol? And on Grace's website, I have a link to Dr. Chetty's research. He's a South African doctor that's probably invested the most time of anybody through the scientific method, trial and error, all these different ways to figure out what the heck is going on. And one of the things he discerned out of his research was that there's a small percentage of the population that has a propensity for inflammation and clotting. And I have both of those. And so what got me into thinking along those lines is because 3 days after Grace died, I ended up in the hospital with COVID, worse than she had. And I think God allowed that in order for me to talk intelligently about Grace's hospital stay in a hospital that bought into the government agenda with COVID versus one that didn't, because I got treated exactly opposite. And even though I almost died the first night, by the end of the second day, I mean, I knew I was going to live. I mean, it was such an opposite treatment that it's hard to even believe. And if Grace would have had the same treatment, she would have lived. So just a quick take-home message here, because if I would have known then on October 6th what I know today, we would have still went to the emergency room, but we would not have went into the hospital. And the reason is because we could have come home with oxygen and a steroid, and you know, Grace would have been fine. But at that point in time, with my what I knew, I just didn't know that was available. I just thought, well, we got to be in the hospital for oxygen. And that simply is not true. So now we can, do you have a question at this point, or do you want me to keep going with the story?
You can, feel free to keep going, please.
So, and feel free to interrupt me too. Just say, Scott, I have a question, and it's fine. I mean, I just come back. I've told the story a number of times, and you know, I did all the research myself, so I know this inside and out. So now the hospital emergency room physician recommended that we admit Grace to the hospital. And at that point, I said, well, then I'll be staying with her. And that was the first objection. So then they said, well, you can't. And I said, what's the reason? And they said, well, we don't allow visitors on the COVID wing. And I said, well, then I'll be taking Grace home. And they had a meeting of whoever, you know, the people in charge were. And after 2 hours, they came back and said, you can stay as long as you don't leave the room. So I said, well, that's no problem. I don't plan on going anywhere. And so Grace and I waited about 10 hours, which is a fairly significant time to wait. And if I forget to bring up the connection with that 10 hours, I don't want to share it now because it kind of sheds light on the end when we start talking about the why. But there's, I think, a very significant reason why we waited 10 hours in the emergency room. Ultimately, about midnight on the 7th, we got into the room and then slept when we could throughout the first night. And I say when we could because these alarms are going off like crazy. And in fact, so much so that I challenged the next morning. I said, what's the reason these alarms are going off? And first, can you just make these alarms go off at the nurse's station? And they said, no, we can't. And I just, you know, you just think about that. We're in the 21st century. We sent a man to the moon in 1969, but you can't make the alarms go off at the nurse's station. And I found out that was a lie, because when I was in the hospital, I asked the same thing. And of course, they respected my wishes, because you got to get sleep if you're going to get well. Anyway, when I asked, you know, what's the main reason they're going off? And they said, well, they put the IV in the crux of Grace's elbow. And so they said, every time she moves, it sets the alarm off. So I said, well, why did you put it there? And they said, well, it was the easiest. You know, it's like, come on. Is that really the goal here, is to do it the easiest? And that was a relatively minor infraction compared to some of the things I'm going to tell you. But it just showed you the tone, the overall tone was one of, we know better than you. We've been doing this 2 years. You don't know anything. You know, you're just a dad. You need to bow down to us, because, you know, we're the COVID experts. We know what's going on. And, you know, that didn't sit well with me. And I was in the mindset of really paying attention. I was on guard. I already didn't have a good trust level for the hospital system in general. You know, basically everybody knows the hospital is a place to necessarily get well. It's a place that if you have an emergency, you go, but you got to pay attention, not at the level that I thought that I know now. But I mean, at that point, I was still paying attention because this is my daughter. So the first day was just goofing around, Grace and I. I just thought, well, we're going to have 3-4 days in the hospital. We're going to watch movies, eat off the menu, and just goof off. And the first day was like that until later in the evening, she got a little frustrated. They had changed out the cannula, the oxygen cannula from the emergency room, to what's called a high flow cannula. And as I now understand, that was really not necessary. These are things the hospital does to ratchet up their reimbursement rates and to get you kind of in a mindset that they know better. Ultimately, that high flow cannula, so this thing is shooting air up your nose, you know, at a fairly high rate, and Grace got frustrated with it. So then I worked with the nurses for 2-3 hours on and off to get her situated with a BiPAP mask. And during that time, toward the end of that time, Grace's blood pressure was at 235 over 135 and her heart rate was at 150. And it's simply because of how much she was struggling with it and wrestling with us. You know, at the end, this is just typical Grace. She said, you know, she knew she was not cooperating. And she just gave me a big hug and said, I'm sorry, Dad. And then it was all fine. So then we get up the next morning, 8 o'clock in the morning, the doctor came in, and this is a fairly significant event. In fact, this one and the next one are real important in this narrative that I'm explaining really goes beyond COVID. So now, you know, the liberals have shut COVID down because the elections are coming up. So now there's not COVID anymore, but what I'm talking about is going to survive COVID, because there's a lot deeper agenda and the hospitals are part of that process. So what they do to get you involved thinking that you've got to do things is they set it up. So this doctor came in at 8 o'clock on October 8th and said, you got to put your daughter on a ventilator in the next 2 hours. And I said, well, what is that based on? And he said, it's based on the blood gas numbers we drew last night. I said, well, what time did you draw the numbers? He said, 11:30. And then I explained to him what I just got done explaining to the two of you, that we had, you know, Grace's blood pressure, her beats per minute, you know, just it that can't be a solid number that we can base a decision on. And so then I requested that they take a new blood gas draw, and they did, and she was fine. Interestingly, one of the nurses that was in the room with the doctor, this really clued me in, because at this point, I mean, I knew ventilators weren't the way to go, but that it clued me in. And then I studied ventilators while I was in the hospital right after this event happened. And I really studied, and I called the doctor that's helped us through all of this. And we walked through it. And anyway, I said to the doctor, what's the prognosis with a ventilator? To my surprise, he was fairly truthful. He said, only 20% of the people walk out alive after they're put on a ventilator, which, you know, the facts are it's only 15%, but I mean, that was close. And the nurse that was with him started crying. And, you know, I know why, because she knew if I made that decision right then, Grace was going to die. And so we dodged the ventilator bullet at that point, but because she cried, that got me into, okay, what are we going, you know, what is this all about? And so then, you know, the paradigm with ventilators, just process, you know, when this whole thing first started with COVID, you know, we were told that there's a ventilator shortage. We got to get the whole country manufacturing these ventilators. So the ventilator paradigm is that ventilators are good, but they are not good. Ventilators have a place, but they do not have a place with COVID. That's not where they're necessary. In fact, COVID pneumonia is mislabeled. They call it COVID pneumonia, but it is not at all a regular pneumonia.
And just to kind of, just to jump in here for 2 seconds and to speak to what you were saying about there being a ventilator shortage, I've seen video and footage, photos of unused ventilators being thrown away in landfills. So we know that's not true, but obviously
it's still the majority of people still think that it's a tool that you need for COVID. Mm-hmm. And I'm here to tell you, it is not a tool you want to use for COVID, because it is
definitely not.
Well, so, and I think to speak to even that nurse who was crying, because I can't tell you how many healthcare professionals I have spoken to in the last 2 years who have seen with their own eyes that their patients that they have been taking care of have died specifically because of that ventilator decision. And the very sad part that they don't have somebody there to advocate for them. Now, can you imagine if you were not there to advocate for her? And that is what we have seen happen time and time again. And even personal stories I know about of people in the hospital alone and not able to speak up for themselves and not think that they can. And then they get put on a ventilator and then they pass away.
That's spot on. And it's the lack of advocacy is a significant reason as to why they're able to pull off these ventilator situations. And I'm going to, with the segue, your situation is a perfect segue into the next piece. So just to finish up what they do, and then I'm going to explain how they pull this off with situations when there's not an advocate. So how they do this is they ask, so after this first event, they asked Cindy and I, Cindy had the medical power of attorney. They asked us 4 different times if we would give them permission just in case Grace needed a ventilator. And they always couched it this way. They said, these type of things tend to happen in the middle of the night when you can't get a hold of the family. So we rejected that every time. We rejected 100% because, I mean, get a hold of us. And on top of that, we already knew this, we're not going to do a ventilator. There's basically no reason to ever do a ventilator. But you think about the unsuspecting public that hasn't spent time understanding this, and they couch it that way. It's a sales pitch. And there's a specific reason there's a sales pitch. It's because of the money trail. And we'll get into the money trail later on. And so we rejected it at 4 different times. So the setup is this. And so this is the next event. So on October 9th, this was on Saturday, Grace was pretty hungry. I ordered food. I started feeding her. She hadn't eaten much on the 8th. On the 7th, we ate normal. But on the 8th, she hadn't eaten much. And so I started feeding her. A nurse comes running in and says, you can't do that. I said, what's the reason? And she said, her oxygen saturation is only at 85%. There's a monitor that she can see outside the room. It's facing, I can see it if I go around the bed, but it was facing such that she's seeing it all the time. Yeah, I was watching it, but I'm not paying close attention to it because she's on a BiPAP and she's fine. So anyway, I started processing that and thinking, she can't be at 85. That's impossible. And I had all of my COVID material in the room knowing I'm going to get COVID. My daughter's aerosoling COVID. So unless God gives me a pass, I'm going to get COVID. And so one of the things I had in my materials is my own oxygen saturation finger meter. So I put it on Grace. It read 95%. And so then I called the nurse back in. I said, is my finger meter accurate? And she said, yes, it is. I said, well, why is my $50 meter more accurate than your $50,000 meter? And she said, well, the leads get sweaty. I said, you know, at this point, I said, you got to be kidding me. I said, if that's the case, why don't you proactively change out these leads every 3-4 hours or whatever it takes so you have an accurate measurement? Given this is the primary statistic you are using to manage my daughter's care. And she snottily responded to me, you should just be thankful you caught this. After the fact,
wow.
After I got all the records, one of the records I requested was the bill that got sent to Medicaid. Grace was disabled, having Down syndrome, so she was on Medicaid. This is another significant factor that's going to come in when we talk about the why behind this. The Medicaid, so the hospital billed Medicaid for 3 lead change outs in 7 days. And the billed cost to Medicaid is only $78 a lead. And so, I mean, so they're purposely, so I've come to the conclusion, they are purposely reducing the oxygen level that's recorded. And we caught them between myself and my daughter. We caught them multiple times. The last day there was a 40-point difference between the finger monitor and the hospital. And so if you just think about what, it's huge. Why would they do this? You think, well, what would be their motivation of doing this? Well, if they've bought into the money trail with this agenda, you know, the families, if they, you know, we've delved into it. I mean, we've reviewed all the records and have really got into it. But what about the family that doesn't? Well, then they go by the wayside. They never know what really happened. But the ones that get the records, they see the records. Okay, my uncle was in the hospital. They ended up venting him. The reason they vented him is because he couldn't maintain his oxygen above 80. Well, was that even an objective number?
Right.
The story I'm telling you is that I don't believe anything they tell me anymore. I think it's, you know, when you look at how they structure their doctor's reports and how they worded things specifically, and it's like, I mean, they are trying to thread a needle so that if anybody digs, they can't be tagged with anything. And, you know, we've dug enough that they're getting tagged. And as we move forward, it's a lot's going to come out, which is exciting. Okay. So then we move into kind of an exciting day, I guess you would say. So now Sunday the 10th, you can't make this up. All this whole story you can't make up. But Sunday the 10th at 7:00 in the morning, the head nurse came in with an armed guard and said, you need to leave immediately. And I said, what is that based on? And she said, it wasn't quite as calm as I'm laying this out right now, but yeah, this was an hour of arguing with her back and forth with the armed guard there. And she said, well, you've been shutting off the alarms at night. And I said, well, that's because I had the nurses train me how to do it. I said, the alarms are going off 20, 25 times a night. And it's often 30 minutes before they come in. So I had them train me how to do it. And then she said, second of all, the last 3 shifts of nurses don't want you in the room. And so, of course, you realize why, because I'm challenging the stuff that they're doing, which interestingly, when the hospital report, the official report came out, so I'm going to back up a long ways here. So when we decided to go public with this story was on December 2nd. Between Grace's death and December and November 8th, that window of time. So Grace died October 13th. Between then and November 8th, we put all of our research together. We had a doctor helping us. We got all the records. I had taken contemporaneous notes. I had my daughter write her notes. We wrote letters, put this all together in a package, emailed this whole research package to the hospital and requested a meeting with the hospital and doctor. That was my biblical responsibility to meet the people who did this to see, you know, what am I missing? You know, or, you know, hopefully they repent of what they did. On December 2nd, they rejected the meeting. And so that's when we went public with this story. And we haven't heard boo from them since going public. Anyway, so in their official response to that letter, this is the third reason the nurse brought up, and this is the thing that's in the official response. Of course, they ignore the fact that the nurses didn't want me challenging. So then the third one is, we suspect you have COVID, she says to me. Well, no kidding, I have COVID. I've already had it for 3 days. I got it on October 7th. And if you were concerned, why weren't you testing me? In fact, you're the one who told me I was going to get it. That's why I couldn't leave the room. You know, so it's so frustrating to see these people lie right to your face in the responses.
Well, and just to ask a quick question, because I think you bring up a valid point of the frustration that so many people have right now of this, like, why do they act this way? What really are they thinking in these hospitals? And you wonder, is it that they are really brainwashed themselves, or is it that they're too afraid for their job to speak up? What do you feel like in that scenario? What was the motivator behind these actions of the nurses?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say that there's multiple things going on. I can't know for sure, but the fear of losing the job, I actually would put that as number three, but I think it's there. Number two, I would put that they have, I think they actually believe they're doing good. And there is a narrative out there that, you know, they're called useless eaters. So Grace was a useless eater. You know, she's disabled, you know, Down syndrome kids already, 67% of them are killed before they're even born. She's a useless eater. So they don't, you know, the elderly are in the same class. And we're going to talk about that a little bit more when we talk about the why. But if they're in a useless eater classification, and now you have these medical professionals that are all in their 30s and 40s, and, you know, they think that they're doing good for society by, you know, we got to reduce the population, right? I mean, that's all part of what we've got to do is to sustain the planet. And, you know, of course, I'm being facetious because I don't believe that at all. I think God's in charge.
But that's a very real narrative. That,
and I think a lot of them
don't have any children, or you should only have one child, or don't have any children at all.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, I have not said this on the air yet, but this narrative has been pitched. So I went to kindergarten back in 1968, and the Weekly Readers in 1968 already said they were telling the kids, the 5-year-olds in kindergarten, that's irresponsible to have more than two children. So that's 1968. So mm-hmm. It's been going on a long time. So then the number one reason, so we're thinking about what caused them to do this. Well, there is, in one of the pieces of research I put on Grace's website, it's under the tragedy tab. I make reference to what's called the Stanford Prison Experiment. If you haven't heard of that, which not too many people have, one of the attorneys had clued me in on this, but it was done in the 90s. They were supposed to do a 2-week experiment where just normal people, half of them were assigned a role as guards and half of them as prisoners. And after 6 days, they had to shut the experiment down. It was out of control. So just, you know, supposedly good people put into a circumstance or a situation where, you know, the variables, they could do whatever they want, and the guards started taking advantage of the prisoners, and it became out of control. They just had to shut it down. So what's the reason? Well, society thinks that people are inherently good. God says we're inherently bad. In fact, we can't do anything good without him. And he says our nature is inherently bad. And it shows in this hospital setting that if you have a government incentive of money, you have immunity from liability. And then in most cases, you have a shroud of secrecy because there's no advocate. What's happening behind closed doors is our human nature, and it's our human nature gone awry. So that's an outstanding question.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you for sharing that too. Didn't mean to get you off track.
Well, that's okay. I told you, this is what welcome that. I want you to keep doing that because this makes it a wonderful interview. So now I called an attorney friend of mine from the room. He said, because the nurse threatened to call the Appleton Police Department if I didn't leave. And he said, Scott, just leave peacefully. And so the armed guard walked me all the way out to my truck. And he said to me at the truck, he said, Scott, you should take this to a higher level because, well, he didn't say the why, but I mean, his why was implied because he watched this exchange and he knew it wasn't right.
Right.
So now we ended up, thankfully, our special needs attorney was available on Sunday. I texted her and then she called me back and I told her what happened. And so she coached me on negotiating with the hospital. So Monday morning, I called patient relations and called three different times. The manager finally called me back at 1 o'clock. I explained the situation. Of course, she worked for the hospital. And so, you know, Grace had a right to an advocate. Yeah. Not just because she was a human, but mm-hmm. she has a statutory right under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And so this patient relations manager said she wanted to have our attorney's contact information. And I wasn't leaving anything to chance at this point. I knew we had to get an advocate in. My wife, Cindy, could not be the advocate because she had COVID. So I had my daughter, Jessica, on board right away. I said, Jess, this is what's going on. I want you to have your bags packed so that once I say go, she lives in Appleton, so she could be there in 10 minutes. So I emailed the patient relations manager while she's there. I wanted to make sure she received the email with the attorney's contact information, and they were able to work it out in a little over an hour. Jessica got there about 2:30 in the afternoon. This was on Monday. The hospital attorney didn't communicate to the floor that Jessica could stay overnight. So she had to leave at 7. She couldn't come back the next day, which was the second to last day of Grace's life until 11 o'clock. So we had a total of 44 hours without advocacy.
Wow.
During that 44 hours, they started, actually before that, when I was in the room, they started this, but I wasn't wise to what was happening. But what they did was they put Grace on a sedative. And Grace never needed to be on a sedative until possibly her last day. And I'll explain why then. But they used a sedative called Presidex. This is very significant because Presidex doesn't get any of the press. Remdesivir gets all the press. And so Remdesivir, I'm just going to cover that quickly because Remdesivir should get press. And it's because if you get 3 or more doses of remdesivir, your death rate is 75%. And that's documented in Ron Johnson's hearing from October 24th.
Yep.
Nicole Saracek, or Saratek, I think it is. I have her video link of her testimony on Grace's website. And she testified to that statistic. And it's, so I mean, remdesivir is no good. We rejected remdesivir. We didn't really have to do it directly. The hospital had said that Grace was beyond the recommended time for remdesivir, I guess. Yeah. So we never had to cross that bridge. But then what they used instead was Presidex. So all of these drugs have what's called a package insert. I'm going to explain what that is. Those are the those are the rules that you're supposed to follow. So if you're a medical professional, you decide that your patient needs to be on Presidex, you're supposed to follow the package insert. Nurses familiar with that drug, and I'll read one. So the doctor that helped us go through the record, she's also a nurse, and so her description of Presidex, I'm just going to read it. Presidex is a med used for anesthesia to put people to sleep for surgery and procedures. Depending on the dose, it can induce a coma-level sleep. Most nurses say that it's only used for 3 hours as an anesthesia before surgery. And the package insert says to not use it for more than 24 hours. They had they had Grace on it 4 full days before her last day.
Oh,
wow.
And so what's the reason? I mean, you can't, it's sickening. So the reason that I believe is the case, so another nurse who studied Presidex but got out of the field, and then she was studying it as inpatient admissions, she said that the reason they're putting people on Presidex is they're setting up the intubation. And so it makes it so they can put a vent in a person in seconds because they're already sedated. So that was her conclusion after studying records.
I have heard that before. I've heard in many cases where people were vented that they had been put on sedatives beforehand. I think Nurse Erin also talked about that. I don't know if you're aware who she is, but she's the nurse that was working at Elmhurst in New York. And she spoke about that, about how they, you know, they would put people on these sedatives prior to getting them on the ventilators. So I think they've been doing that for the last 2 years.
Which, I mean, you could understand the logic of if a person needed a ventilator to sedate them for, you know, like a surgery procedure, mm-hmm. you can see the logic of that, but
right.
not as a tool to just sedate somebody.
Right.
You know, so how, again, this attorney that's really, he's given me some clues to really think about this, right? And then I drill him down. So he said, Scott, do you think that if you were in that hospital, they would have put you on sedation? And the answer was no. So why did they do it to Grace? And I believe, and as the story unfolds, you'll see why I think this. I think they did it because she has Down syndrome. Mm. And so they could. And it made their job easier than what it, you know, especially when we didn't have advocacy. When Jess and I were in the room, I mean, Grace is just our buddy. She's no problem to take care of. She's a snap. But to a hospital.
At this point, when they started the Precedex, what were her symptoms? I mean, was she getting worse? Was she getting better? It's probably hard to know if you were not there to be able to advocate for her all the time, but was there some significant drop in her health?
Absolutely not. So remember, I said they started this when I was still there. You know, Grace was doing great. I would see absolutely no reason. In fact, the doctor's reports during that time when they started Precedex showed that she was doing fine. Mm. You know, she was just level. You know, the thought process was, you know, she just needs to work through this on oxygen and a steroid. And then she, you know, she comes out of it, then we're good to go.
I am curious too, because, you know, recently I got into, I don't want to say an argument, let's say a discussion with the medical doctor about ivermectin. And was there a point in this when you were there that you were pushing for certain treatment, and did you get pushback on that?
That's another great question. I just want to make sure I say this about Precedex so I'll forget. What happens when somebody's put on Precedex, two things happen that are significant. Number one, the hospital now gets an ICU bonus. And the patient does not leave the room. All that changes is the status for payment. So the patient does not leave, but they get paid more once they're on Precedex. And then you are classified. If I wanted to take Grace home, then I just said, I had enough. She's coming home with me. It's not that easy because it's called against medical advice. So the way I understand against medical advice, the only way to take your loved one home at that point is agree that they're going to be on hospice care and that you're going to be taking care of the bill personally, which of course I would have been glad to take care of the bill. I don't care about that. Mm-hmm. So your question about the meds, no, we never ran into that challenge. And the reason was, is because I was able to give Grace ivermectin myself.
That's good awesome. For you. So, good for you. And that's good probably why she was getting better.
Right.
So we never had to, you know, it did come up though, not mm-hmm. directly, but you know, I'll share with you, yeah, this is so unbelievable. They had such a bias towards us.
Of course, because you're actually advocating and you actually have a brain and common mm-hmm. sense. So of course they have a bias against right. you.
They well, don't
the
want
bias, though, go ahead.
No, so they don't want anyone in there who's willing to speak up and advocate for their loved ones. It's not what they want. They want everyone just to kind of agree. And if you don't agree, you get escorted out with an armed guard by use of intimidation and sometimes force, right? Just completely unfair.
Oh, I agree 100%. I think that's no doubt why I got escorted out. I reviewed at this attorney's, you know, prompting, really, because he asked me those questions that I mentioned. So then I reviewed the records. This was a couple of Sundays ago. I reviewed the records two more times. And in the records, so Grace was visited by 22 different doctors in 7 days. And the reason I know that is because there's 22 doctors' reports. So in those reports, they reference the fact that Grace was not vaccinated 6 times. Okay, so what was the reason for that? They referenced that we're Christians 3 times. They referenced the frontline doctors' misinformation campaign, that we're following the frontline doctors' misinformation campaign 4 times. The head COVID doctor, this is what he wrote in his report October 8th. Remember, October 7th is Grace's first day. This guy was a complete jerk. In fact, just to give you a perspective, when he evaluated Grace the day he came in, you know, they're coming in for 5 seconds and getting paid $5,000. You know, so he's evaluating Grace. I'm in the bathroom and he makes some reference that he's here. I said, just hold on. I'm going to be out in 30 seconds. He would not wait. Instead, he called me back and started talking down to me. And I said to him, I realize you think you're a God, but I don't think you're a God. And if you don't stop talking to me this way, I am hanging up. And that's literally how it was. So then he wrote in his report on October 8th, he, the father, believes in the frontline doctor stuff and does not really believe or trust us here in the healthcare setting, which I think is going to be to the detriment of his daughter, to be honest. This is right out of his report. So, you know, what is
it? They really do actually think they are gods and have a God complex, many of them. So there is no doubt about that.
Well, this guy certainly fit that. It's like, wow. You know, and I can put up with a lot that then, you know, I don't really care if the guy has a God complex. I care about if he gets my daughter well. Mm-hmm. So I had this happen one time when I had knee surgery. I had a doctor that I really didn't care for, but he was supposedly the best knee surgery doctor. So I thought, well, it doesn't matter. I don't care.
Yeah.
You know, and when push came to shove with that surgery, I mean, he did a stellar job. So I really didn't care about his attitude. I just cared about getting my daughter well. Yeah. After the fact, now that I've studied everything, I realized this attitude is, you know, it's probably built in him, but it's been over 2 years of following a protocol that doesn't work.
Right. I'm really curious, Scott, was there at any point in time a discussion about your daughter actually getting better from the doctors and nurses who were treating her? Just based on what you're telling me, it just seems like they just had just one path. Did they ever talk about the possibility of her getting better and going home?
Only one time. And it was an interesting discussion. And it was with one of the doctors that it seemed I could have a frank discussion with. And he said this was on October 9th. I said to him, I really want to get Grace home. I mean, she's doing well. And he said, well, you can't get a BiPAP for home. And she would need to go home on a BiPAP, which he was lying at that time. I found out after the word that she never needed a BiPAP.
Well, you requested the BiPAP, didn't you? Because she was on the,
outstanding. But I did unknowingly. So so after the fact, we researched, what do people really need for oxygen? So, you know, Grace probably could have just got by with her CPAP mask the entire time. And that's what we learned through the research after the fact that we supplied to the hospital. But the doctor, and my mindset was, you know, they're telling me the truth. You know, so she's on a high flow cannula because we got to get this oxygen in. So if that doesn't work, we got to go to BiPAP. You know, so yeah, I mean, I was in that mindset after the fact.
Right.
That was wrong. I was 100% wrong.
But also when you requested the BiPAP, you were more or less kind of requesting it because it was just more comfortable for her. Right. I mean, so
absolutely.
It wasn't right. Even something, because I just want to make sure that people listening understand this. So the hospital, it wasn't their decision to give her a BiPAP. So that could have been an option had they suggested it or, gave you that option to take her home on oxygen without a BiPAP, because she didn't need one, according to them, initially, right?
Exactly. She didn't need one. And in fact, the doctor, so when he said, you know, he didn't object to her going home, but he said, you know, you can't get a BiPAP for home. I said, well, what, how do you know? And he said, well, you just can't get one. So then, you know, my personality is such that I like to challenge stuff. So then I started calling oxygen supply places, and 9 minutes later I had a BiPAP. So I called him back in. I said, well, I found a BiPAP. He said, you did? And so then he actually wrote the prescription for the BiPAP. So, wow. You know, if we would have chosen to take Grace home, then we would have had a BiPAP at home. So, I mean, he seemed shocked that I was able to do it, but I don't know. There's so many lies going on. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't
know what happened. Yeah. So at this point, you know, she's had the Precedex.
Yes.
And what is that next step now?
Okay. So now October 12th, so Jessica's there the full day. She stays overnight. Grace had a great day. They're doing the sister things like Grace and I were doing the dad things, you know, and before Grace went to bed that night, she sat up in bed and they called Jessica's two boys, Grace's nephews, my grandkids on FaceTime, and Grace sat up through the BiPAP and hollers, hi boys. You know, so that tells you how well she's doing. Her oxygen level all night long was 98, 99 all night.
Wow. So
she was doing so well that at 8 o'clock the next morning, the doctor called us and he said, well, Grace had a great day yesterday. I think we should put a feeding tube in. That wasn't his motivation of calling. His motivation of calling was he had asked us the evening before to give this permission for a vent again and wanted our decision. So we told him no, but then he told us how great Grace was doing. We should do a feeding tube. Remember, she really never needed a feeding tube. She needed one at that point because she's malnutrition, because they wouldn't let us feed her. And then the nurses only gave her a couple protein shakes. And she should have been fed the whole time. So now we foolishly approve this. And you'll see why I say foolishly, because they use this as an excuse to ratchet up the Precedex again. So now Jessica, about 8:30, says to the nurse, I'm going to take a shower. She said, well, you can't do that. You got to go home. So remember when I was in there, they said you couldn't leave the room. I took a shower every morning right in the room. They told Jessica, you've got to go home. So she lives in town. She buzzes home. She's back inside of an hour. She's figuring she's going to be there for 3-4 days, right? So she comes back then, and she overhears two doctors and a nurse in the hallway say the family's not going to like this. This really gets tough to talk about now. This story gets so unbelievable at this point that that's why I posted all my research, because somebody listening to me live would think I'm, in fact, some people have already said they think that I'm lying about it, but the research is all there. Everything I've taken is right out of the records.
Well, so, we know you're not lying. And there are sadly so many other people who've gone through this, and I'm one of them. So just FYI. So I fully understand what you're going through. I went through something similar with my mother last year. So we're listening completely, and there's no doubt in my mind, everything that you're saying here is factual. So thank you, Scott.
So she overhears two of the doctors and a nurse say the family isn't going to like this. So she said, what are they going to like? And they said, well, we had to restrain Grace, which means they strapped her down to the bed. And so she said, well, why'd you do that? Well, she wanted to get up and go to the bathroom. So this is, again, the attorney said to me, well, Scott, do you think you would have been strapped down? And so then I went through the records again that same Sunday. I went through and just looked for Down syndrome. And in the 22 reports, they referenced the fact that Grace had Down syndrome 36 times. So they strapped her down because she had Down syndrome. Wouldn't you just help her out of bed and go to the bathroom? I mean, you're going to make a 19-year-old go to the bathroom in the bed. That's insane.
That would have been the compassionate and humane thing to do.
Yes. So now they use that as an excuse to ratchet up the Precedex. Shortly after that, now Grace's oxygen is low. And instead of just waiting for her to rebound, they put the feeding tube in. Now they ratchet the Precedex up again. Now it's at maximum dose at 1048. Remember I showed you that timeline that's on the website. So now 1048 on that timeline in the morning, the Precedex is at max dose. 11:25, they give her a dose of lorazepam. Now we get into the last 29 minutes. 5:46 p.m., they give her another dose of lorazepam. Remember, she's already on max dose of Precedex. 5:49, 3 minutes later, another dose. 6:15, they give her a 2 milligram dose of morphine as an IV push. If you read the package insert for morphine, which is posted on Grace's website, it is the most damning document against the hospital that I could ever produce. And it's not produced by me. It's the rules they're supposed to follow. It says to not combine morphine with lorazepam or Precedex. Because it causes death. And then on top of that, if you use morphine, you're supposed to have the reversal drug bedside and monitor the patient. And I mean, the doctor that interviewed me this morning, when I told this, he said they could have just reversed it right then with the reversal drug. Well, no kidding, but they didn't want to, and I can prove it. So now Jessica notices after this dose of morphine, Grace is getting cold. So she goes and tracks one of the nurses down and said, my sister's getting cold. Can you take a temperature? And they said to her, that's normal. Well, it's normal if your goal is to kill somebody. It's not normal at all. At 7:20, Jessica calls Cindy and I on FaceTime and said, Dad, Grace's numbers are dropping like crazy. I said, get the nurses in. She said, I've been trying. They won't come in. She estimated 30 nurses in the hallway at this point. Why so many is because it was shift change. So now we start hollering, save our daughter. My wife and I are hollering, save our daughter. They holler back, she's DNR, do not resuscitate. And so this is the first we know she's DNR. How does she get to be DNR? So we didn't ask those questions then. We just said, she's not DNR, save our daughter. They would not come in that room. Jessica ran out in the hallway about 7:22, she estimated. So this is in Jessica's report that we sent to the hospital. In November, she wrote, one nurse read off what the computer stated and that the doctor labeled her as a DNR, which they claimed they couldn't do anything about. In going through the hospital records, we found that to be the case. The doctor did this. We didn't do this. In the official hospital response to us about that DNR question, they said, Cindy and I approved it. Just process that. Why would we approve it? Why would we approve a DNR when the doctor tells us how great our daughter's doing? If Grace is going to die, we're not going to put a feeding tube in. That doesn't make any sense, right?
No, none at all.
And on top of that, the state statute, I'm just going to read this out of the state statute. This is maybe the second most damning thing. Maybe the first most, because, I mean, they could have saved our daughter right then. So for a DNR to be valid, though this is Wisconsin state statute, most state statutes are going to mirror this because you know, just intuitively you would think you can't just put a DNR on somebody without, you know, the patient or the parent agreeing to it, right?
Yeah.
So it says specifically the healthcare agent, which was my wife, must request the DNR, number one. Number two, the healthcare agent must consent to the DNR. Number two, neither one happened. Third, it must be in writing and signed by the healthcare agent. Well, it didn't happen. In fact, the doctor called us at 8 o'clock. If he wants to stand on that 8 o'clock in that phone call that we agreed to a DNR, why didn't he tell us, come in and sign this? Or we have a fax machine right now, so why not just fax it over, right? Because it's got to be signed to be legal. They're supposed to put a DNR bracelet on a DNR patient. Well, of course, that didn't happen, but that's minor. The biggie is this. A guardian or healthcare agent may revoke a DNR order by giving direction to resuscitate the patient. Mm-hmm. So when my wife and I said, she's not DNR, save our daughter, even if we would have put the DNR on Grace, it revoked it. But we didn't do it, but it revoked the doctor DNR. They would not do it. And it seems outlandish what I'm telling you, but the story actually gets worse than this. So after the fact, Jessica, you know, we're talking about this, obviously. Jessica said there was an armed guard outside the door. So what's the reason there's an armed guard outside the door? And, you know, you can come up with only three reasons that I can think of. Number one is to prevent any nurse from having a conscience to come in and save our daughter. Number two, from preventing my daughter, Jessica, from running out in the hall and grabbing a nurse by the hair to save her. And number three, thinking I'm going to come back. And so just so you know, this wasn't just a casual walk by an armed guard. He was there for this purpose. And I can prove that too. So after Grace died, Jessica laid in the bed with Grace for about 20 minutes. And she said, "Dad, the armed guard, remember I told you about the nurse's window outside that they could watch the monitors? The mm-hmm. armed guard stood out there and watched Jessica the whole time she's in bed with Grace."
Wow.
So she watched Grace pass away right in front of her. And
so did we. At 7:27, Grace died. We watched it on FaceTime. And then that's when Jessica crawled in bed with Grace while I drove my wife to the hospital. I couldn't come in at that point. So then Jess and Cindy cleaned Grace up. Our pastor met us there. The funeral director met us there. And then what clued us into research was this moment, which this is significant to our research, not in the story, but the pastor was walking my wife out in a wheelchair, and one of the nurses had Grace's belongings on a cart. And she bent down to Cindy and said, "Me and several of the other nurses don't think Grace should have died today." So then we knew at that point something happened.
Have you had a chance to have a conversation with any of those nurses?
Yeah, strangely, no. We did receive a letter, not a letter, an email from the nurses, the nurse who gave Grace that dose. Her husband emailed me a couple weeks ago. And because I even forgot I did this. I'd written an editorial for Wisconsin Christian News, and I had put the doctor and nurse's name in the editorial, and he wanted me to remove their name because of fear for his family. And so then I thought, you know, I processed it a bit, and then I prayed about it, and because I didn't know what to do, you know, what do you do? I mean, we'll talk at the end about where's God in all of this, but I was walking, we have a shed, and I was walking back from the shed to the house, and I just asked God, what do you want? What do you want me to do with this? And it just popped into my head at that point, meet with them. So then I emailed them back and I said, you know, I'd really like to meet with you and your wife. And they rejected that. So that's the only conversation that we've had.
Wow.
So that's the whole story, you know, we just went through a long process of what happened. How did they pull it off? And, you know, we transitioning to the most important point is why. Well, the most important point is where was God in all this? But why did this happen? Mm-hmm. So now we go into speculation. Everything that I've said so far is fact. But mm-hmm. now we go into speculation. So did they do this for the money? So on Grace's website, I have a whole section called The Love of Money where I've documented this. And it's extensive. That's maybe the section that I put the most time in. Because there's quite a money trail. The average bonus that a hospital gets from the government for COVID is $100,000. Mm-hmm. And that's documented on the website. And when a patient goes on a ventilator, they get a $39,000 bonus.
Right.
That translates into about $300,000, not in bonuses, but about $300,000 total, because they get a bonus for the ventilator, they get an ICU bonus. They're going to get a Precedex bonus, but then they also keep the average patient stays alive for 22 days on a vent. So then they get the insurance and patient reimbursement for 22 days. And so you put it all together, and this is a huge, it's like hitting triple sevens on the slot machine for the hospital. This COVID bonus, as it applies to Grace, died at St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Appleton, Wisconsin. That's part of Ascension Hospital system, which is 142 hospitals. It's a supposedly a faith-based Catholic hospital system, but I mean, you really wonder about that with what's going on. In fact, they have $26 billion in the bank at the end of their last fiscal year, and they have it tied into a private equity fund that George Soros is part of. So you really just wonder what's going on. Anyway, I estimated that they received $8.3 billion in government bonus payments in the first year of COVID. And, wow. And it's just astronomical numbers.
That's as it applies to number.
oh, it's huge as it applies to grace. And then you think, okay, well, why did they take her? If money was the motivation, why would they take her out? And so again, this is speculation. But just put the puzzle pieces together. So remember I told you I got the bill that they sent to Medicaid. They were only making gross $1,680 a day on Grace. By killing Grace, they got a $13,000 COVID bonus. The day that Grace died, what do you think the hospital capacity or the rate of capacity was? Well, they were, you guessed it, they were at 100%. So now we go back when I told you that Grace and I waited 10 hours in the emergency room. What were we waiting for? So my guess is what we were waiting for was somebody to die. And so now we have people stacked up like cordwood. You know, they're announcing on the news. This was during the Delta variant. You know, people can't, the emergency rooms are full, right? And in Appleton, the emergency rooms are full. They're announcing on the air. So people are stacked up like cordwood. You know, Grace is an easy one to take out. And then it fits into the narrative. So it fits with the money, right? They're not making much money on Grace because we wouldn't approve event. They get a $13,000 bonus for taking her out. There's people stacked up like cordwood. Then there's the attenuated care model, which means ration care. Dr. Elizabeth Valit has really done a great job drilling this down. She started Truth for Health Foundation. Dr. Peter McCullough is involved with her with that foundation. And this idea of taking out the elderly and the disabled is alive and well. Of course, nobody's going to go on TV in the government and say, hey, guess what, everybody? We think that the disabled and the elderly are useless eaters, so we just want to take them all. But they used COVID as a cover, and I can prove this beyond, I would say, beyond a shadow of a doubt. All this research, again, is under love of money on the website. So after Grace died and the hospital rejected our request for meeting, we went public. So part of going public is I filed complaints with the department that regulates physicians in Wisconsin, the department that regulates hospitals in Wisconsin, and the Department of Justice federally, which is in charge of implementing the Americans with Disabilities Act. The Department of Justice, all the findings are on the website. The Department of Justice said they're too busy. The hospital investigation concluded the hospital didn't do anything wrong. The doctor one, which I'm going to read to you, and this is mind-blowing stuff.
I love how organized you are with everything. And this is amazing because I think there are so many people out there listening to this who have been in your situation, and this is really going to help people put the pieces of the puzzle together.
Well, thank you very much. God made me this way, so I can't take any credit. And a lot of times people wonder, what is their purpose on this earth? Well, I've got my purpose right now. Mm-hmm. Before this time, I just was a dumb dad. But now I know what my purpose is, at least at this point. So this is dated January 20th from the Wisconsin Department of Safety and Professional Services. This is the regulatory agency for physicians. And so I have this point underlined, and it's shocking. So it says the details of the complaint, this was the complaint I filed on December 2nd, were reviewed and evaluated by a screening panel made up of members of the regulatory authority for the profession and or a department attorney. So that's your first clue, something's going on. They didn't get an outside panel. They didn't get anybody objective. It was all their own people that evaluated the doctor, okay? So you'll see why that's significant in a minute. Based on the review and evaluation of the complaint and other materials, a decision has been made that the information presented does not warrant further investigation. Can you imagine that? So think through what I shared with you, I gave to them. And that's not enough information. I mean, it's more than they've ever got in their entire life, but it's not enough. It's not enough for this bunch of fools. So what's the conclusion? The conclusion is you have the hospitals that are signed on to the government protocol are doing the government's bidding. So now you have a regulatory agency, which is the government. They're investigating what I'm calling another arm of the government. The hospitals who have bought into this have become another arm of the government. Mm-hmm. So now you have the government investigating the government. Well, what do you think? Are they going to become guilty all of a sudden? Well, I mean, they would be. They'd be implicating themselves. So
like,
first, they're not
guilty. The fox guarding the hen house.
Exactly. That's spot yeah. on. So I believe the why has to do with the money, the attenuated care model. And I think this fits into a lot larger agenda. And, you know, it's this, and this is why Grace's story survives COVID, because the larger agenda is these elites worldwide are pushing for a one world government. They call it the Great Reset. So what is that? What is that all about? And I can boil it down for the listeners pretty simple. It's called the sustainability agenda. So they want to convince us that to sustain the planet, we got to be all in on climate control and we have to be all in on health. So with health, Grace's story fits under the health piece. So to be all in on health, we have to all be vaccinated. We have to all be under the same medical plan. And we have to reduce the world population because there is just not enough to go around.
Well, it's socialism 101 for sure.
Absolutely.
I have a question, Scott, too. Like just kind of going back to this complaint that you filed and just getting all this information back, I can imagine it makes you feel like, gosh, maybe one thought is that I would have is how could a human being be so uncaring? How could a human being who is a doctor, who is a nurse, who may be a hospital administrator, how could somebody be so capable of not caring about another human being?
It does. I mean, that's a fantastic question. It does cross, I mean, it crossed my mind a ton at the beginning. You know, after Grace died, I mean, I went to the hospital 3 days after Grace died. And so that was, that was just a unique time to, my daughter just died. Now I'm almost dying. And Jessica called me and she said, Dad, what do I do? You know, Cindy is a basket case. You know, just think about, she's the mom, right? I'm sorry, not being negative. I'm just telling you. So Jessica said, Dad, what do I do? I said, Jess, I can't help. I said, I don't know if I'm going to make it. I said, I want you to start working on Grace's funeral. And I told her literally, I said, if I don't make it, you're going to have two funerals instead of one. But you just got to keep going. And she stepped up and did a great job. And so then you have time to process that question that you asked. And because you think, how could this possibly happen? And then as we dug into the records is when I really started processing it. So every record seemed to be, it's like, this is getting, every time you turn a page, it's worse. It's worse. What is going on? How could they do this? There's a narrative. And, it's, so I had to come to the point that, okay, they did it. I mean, this becomes a fact. And so once I saw that, you start seeing what is our role in this going to be? Are we going to share the story? What are we going to do? And I had to come to grips with forgiveness in that process. Mm-hmm. And I did by the time I sent the information to the hospital, which was first part of November. In the letter I sent that, I even wrote it in there that, I would much rather see the doctor and nurse repent versus anything else. I mean, what do they deserve? They deserve to go to jail for what they did. At a minimum, this story, there's two, the continuum of opportunities is that at a minimum, this was negligence. At a maximum, it's murder one. Mm-hmm. So somewhere between negligence and murder one is what happened.
Right.
And so, if it's more towards this end, they deserve to go to jail. But I would much rather see them repent than go to jail, because think through what's going to happen if they don't. They're going to spend eternity in a place they're not going to like. And, mm-hmm. You don't want to see that happen to your worst enemy. Yeah, I'm a sinner too. Everybody, I've been forgiven, thankfully. And I'd like to see that happen with them. So, I mean, I had to come to grips with that in order to share the story, because otherwise, what are you going to do? Just have an angry dad share a story?
I think that's so profound, because we've all, you know, JM has mentioned she's gone through her own tragedy with her own family, her mom, and I've gone through tragedy with family member and a child. And we come to a place where, how do we use that anger? Because anger often doesn't have really, it just breeds more anger, you know, versus forgiveness. And that's really one of the hardest things that we could ever do as human beings, is have forgiveness.
Well, I would not say that it's one of the harder things that we could ever do. I would actually say it's impossible.
Right.
And that's why, you know, if it was possible that we could forgive at this level, we don't need God.
Right. But
things that are impossible, that's what he's there for. So, I mean, it is, I don't think I could sit here today if he wouldn't have been involved changing my heart to do it and think through what, I mean, now he can use me. And right. we've got to get this message out. We've saved thousands of lives already by getting the message out. And the bigger message is not, you know, so let's say that we, you know, this sounds like a dumb goal, but this is, you know, this is Grace's dad. I'd like to have all 330 million people in this country know Grace's name and know the story, because it's going to save lives. But way more important than that is, so it saves them, you know, so what do I mean by that? And so I want to just explain what I mean by saving lives. What I mean by that is adopt a new hospital paradigm. Most people still have the old paradigm. You trust the white coat. You know, if I take 100% of the blame for Grace's death, it's because I trusted the white coat. And I will never do that again. But I had to walk through this to never do it again. And I'm telling anybody listening, don't trust the white coat. If you need to go to the hospital, check stuff out ahead of time. If you're sitting in the emergency room, it's too late to check things out. You need to do advanced preparation. I have a whole bunch of links on Grace's site that will help you advance prep. You can check hospitals out ahead of time. And we should maybe just spend a couple minutes on my hospital stay, because there's good hospitals out there.
Yes, I was going to say, now maybe it's a good time to go into your experience. That's the total opposite.
Right, it's the total opposite. And so if, just to finish up on this, if every single person changes their hospital paradigm to be awake, you know, wake up, know that they are not necessarily there to help you and you got to be awake, you know, then we're going to have, you know, hundreds of thousands of lives saved. That's fantastic. But if those lives don't turn their, if they're not believers and they don't turn their life over to God, it was all for naught. So more, way more importantly, as I'd love to have this story prick your heart to say, holy cow, this guy sounds real. His research is real. And don't believe me. Look at the research. And if that causes you to say, you know what, I have believed in a man-made system called a government that has led me astray. In fact, I've been duped by that government. And that's the fact. You have been duped. And if you're not awake to that yet, you're going to get awake, because way worse is coming.
Right.
And at that point, God is going to use, I mean, he wants you to come to him. So, I mean, if that happens with the story, then we really hit the mark. So
before, Scott, before you go on to share your experience in the hospital, which is a stark contrast to what Grace went through, I just want to point this out as well, because you had said earlier, you know, who's controlling these and who's making these decisions, and that the hospital's acting like a government. And I think this is exactly true. My feeling on that is, you know, we have a lot of these hospitals who've now been bought out. These private hospitals have been bought out by larger hospitals. I call them companies or corporations now, because they're not really acting as a medical facility that's loving and caring and compassionate towards the people they're supposed to be caring for. But you have the people at the top above who've bought the hospital, who are controlling the hospital. And then everyone has, you know, their role in how all of this plays out. So when you have this higher power controlling the hospital and saying to the administration, this is how it's going to be, and this is the protocol you have to follow. And then you have the administration telling, you know, the doctors and everyone in charge of them, And, you know, just like I said, just trickles down to the bottom to the nurses. And at that point, it becomes like this, all right, I have to do this because this is what I'm told. And then if you don't follow along with what you're being told, nobody likes when someone questions what they're doing. So that's one aspect of it, right? And then no one likes to be challenged of their knowledge, right? Because they're seeing the deaths and they're, you know, this is the COVID narrative is I work here. I'm the nurse. I'm seeing these deaths. Yes, you are seeing these deaths, but you're also, what people need to understand is everyone has a role. Even this nurse who bent over and said to you that they didn't think Grace should have died. That was also a part of this. That person also played a role because everyone has an option. Everyone has a choice whether to continue playing that role or to speak up and walk away and say something, right? And when you have these government controlled facilities, these people get pinned up against the wall. And like you said, whatever the reason why people don't stand up and speak up more. I think there are so many reasons why. It's, you know, that herd mentality, you know, to follow along. And you'd mentioned there have been experiments before with, you know, the guards. You had one line of people acting as the guards and one as the prisoners. And they've done so many studies where people, you know, they'll start a fire in a room and they'll have a group of people like these social experiments. And because one person or the group decides not to leave the room because they think that's the right thing. Oh, we should stay in this room. And someone else is like, no, come with me. And then they don't follow the person who's going to pull them out of the fire. You know, there's so many of these stories in real life, not just in experiments. And I think the hospital system right now is a prime example of that. Everyone just kind of following each other and just following along with whatever that narrative is, not even realizing that they're involved in it.
I think that's spot on. In fact, that is, so I have thought about this from a 30,000 foot view too. And so taking what you just said, but applying it to all of us, not just the hospital. So you can look at, okay, do we blame the nurse who implemented the order for the meds? Do we blame the doctor who issued the DNR? Do we blame the nurses who wouldn't come in the room? Do we blame the security guard who wouldn't let the nurses in the room? Do we blame the hospital administration? Do we blame the government for setting up this crazy protocol that doesn't work? Do we blame the world governments who are all in on this great reset? Do we blame the Chinese for letting loose this virus? Do we blame Fauci for being involved with the Chinese? There's all kinds of people you can blame. But then you take a look at, and I remember as I was thinking about the 30,000 foot view, about 30 years ago, I was studying, and the pastor who was leading the study I was listening to said Billy Graham quipped that if God doesn't judge America, he's going to have to apologize to Sodom and Gomorrah. So this was over 30 years ago. So, you know, we're all to blame because in that regard, we let this happen. If we're all on fire now, what did it take to get us on fire? You know, I had a real comfortable life before this. So you'd see all this stuff going on, but I didn't do anything. So I'm just as guilty, right? In that 30,000 foot view, we all really sat passively aside and we let this happen to us. So this has been happening, you know, for decades. We did a lot of our part. We homeschooled our kids, you know, so we did some things, but I could have been doing this way back, not specifically about hospitals, but, and so you get the picture.
Hmm. Yeah.
So, and, onto my hospital stay, I'll just spend a few minutes on that. So, it was real, really interesting. So the first night I had already said that, they asked me, what would you like to have happen? I said, I just want to sleep. I'll buzz you if I need you. No alarm. So they respected that. I had to go to the bathroom about 2 a.m. I buzzed the alarm because just that walk to the bathroom and back, my oxygen went into the 70s. And so I had to have them crank up the oxygen to the max, and it took a couple hours for it to get back into the 90s. And so then that next morning, one of the nurses came in, and she had a little couple pills. And she said, "I want to go through the pill regimen with you." I said, "Well, what do you have in there?" And she said, "I have a multivitamin, a probiotic, vitamin D, vitamin E, and fish oil." I said, "What?" I said, "You guys don't, you know, I'm on supplements, so I'm familiar with that stuff."
Unbelievable.
I said, "What do you mean? You guys don't believe in that stuff?" And she said, "Well, we do here."
Wow.
Unreal.
Wow.
And so then,
unbelievable.
And just the whole attitude. So now the next thing, you know, this nurse was kind of a comic. And she was in her early 20s, and she was a dry sense of humor. So I started to get my senses. I said, "Can I take a shower?" And she said, "Yes." And I said, "Well, I got all these leads on me, and I'm pretty hairy." And so I said, "Do I take these off or do you take them off?" And she said, "Well, either one of us can." I said, "Why don't you take them off?" So she rips the leads off. Then she says to me, "You know, if you would have scheduled in advance, we'd do free waxing." And she does that straight. You know, no. It was just perfect. It was what I needed at that time. And so then the doctor comes in, and he looks at my numbers. And, you know, after the fact, I realized my numbers were mirroring Grace's numbers, the blood chemistry, because we overlaid them and you see how bad a shape you're in. And he said, "I want to try this drug on you called Biracetidine." And I said, "Spell it." So this is what the same thing I did in Grace's room. So he spells it. And I have my laptop there. So I start researching and I call the doctor that I'm working with. And we both concluded after about 2 hours of research, yep, this drug we think is good. But in the research, it always paired it with remdesivir. So I call him back in. I said, "Yes, I would like to try this drug, but I don't want it paired with remdesivir." And he said, "Fine." And so, I mean, within 24 hours, I knew I was going to live. I mean, everything changed. I mean, the numbers, the stats that they were keeping on me with the blood chemistry, everything reversed. Strangely, that drug was never offered to Grace. And in the doctor's reports, so I challenged that when I wrote the letter back to the hospital requesting the meeting. I asked, "Well, why?" You know, because I explained my hospital stay compared to Grace's. Why wasn't Grace offered this? And they only offered her a drug called tocilizumab. So I looked that drug up when I was there, talked with the same doctor, and the placebo did better than the drug. And the drug had umpteen side effects, so I rejected it. Well, in the doctor's official report, he claims he offered baricitinib to Grace. That's a complete lie. And in the hospital's response, they said the same thing. I was there. It never got offered because I had my laptop. I was looking up the drugs so I could figure out what's going on. Then the last thing they did, I mean, they did a daily, might have even been twice a day, I don't remember. But they came in, the respiratory therapist came in and did a budesonide nebulizer treatment every day. I mean, it was so different, you know, and of course, mm-hmm. And then when I wanted, you know, I wanted to get home because, you know, my daughter died. My wife needs me. My other daughter's planning the funeral. I just needed to get home. And so, you know, I was on oxygen. And, you know, so then I said to him, "Well, I'm ready to go home." And he said, "Well, you know, it's really too early, but you know, I couldn't be on that drug after I was home because you got to be monitored." But he allowed me to go home with oxygen. You know, they did the testing, and so they set me up with oxygen at home. And so it was just a wonderful experience.
What kind of a hospital was it? Was it
it was a regional. So it was a private regional hospital. I think they have five hospitals.
Yeah,
Grace died in Appleton. I went to Green Bay, and it was St. Vincent's in Green Bay. And I mean, I can't say enough about them. They knocked it out of the park.
It's interesting you bring that up because there was another really powerful interview I did with, her name is Allison Lundeen, and I believe they live in Wisconsin as well. And her father died at the hands of the medical system in Wisconsin as well. And then they had a completely different experience at a regional hospital in Wisconsin. So it's just interesting to me, maybe where the money's coming from, and that makes a big difference versus, you know, these larger systems that are so tied to the government versus a regional private system.
Right.
Well, it sure seems like that. I mean, it's still a choice. You know, they don't have to buy into that, but I mean, that temptation, I mean, it's a big temptation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, think about improving your balance sheet by $8.3 billion in bonus payments in 1 year. Mm-hmm. You know, that's quite a temptation.
I had a guest on who had brought up this other, there's a website. I'll have to get it for you later, Scott, but it was, I had never heard of it before, but you could go on there and you can look up the doctors, the physicians who are prescribing these medications and seeing how much they're getting for each one specifically. And she had done that with a doctor who had prescribed a medication to her father. And it's mind blowing when you start to track and look at all of these numbers, in addition to what the hospital's getting too. Everybody's just making a lot of money on, you know, counting on you being in there and being sick. But it is interesting, you know, that it is these specific hospitals that are doing this, that are, I think for the most part, it's rare that you see people coming out okay out of these larger hospitals. It does tend to be these smaller private hospitals that are trying these other alternative treatments or just basic care, you know, oxygen and supplements, right?
When I got there, it didn't start quite the same, but when I got into the room, it was awesome. But when I got there, I was in the emergency room and the doctor came in right away and he said, "Are you vaccinated?" I said, "No." And so then he started giving me a vaccination lecture. And I said, "Listen, I don't need this now. I just need oxygen." He would rather lecture me on getting being vaccinated than get me what I need. I mean, what is having a hard time breathing?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm still trying to wrap my head around the fact that, you know, Grace was doing so well. Her oxygen levels were up. She was sitting up in bed. She was communicating. And then the next day or so,
it was complete
opposite. So it just doesn't make sense. This isn't something, you know, she had COVID and people recover. We know the recovery rate, right? I mean, her chances of surviving, had they not given her this deadly cocktail of medications, would have been 100%. Had she gone to another facility, things would have been different for sure, right?
If she would have went to the one I went to, I mean, she'd be alive. Yeah, I would. Grace brought joy into this world. You know, I'm just a crusty old guy. You know, I would have much rather have gone to her hospital and her going to the hospital I went, because, you know, she had her whole life to live. And, yeah, it's tough. She was my best buddy. It's tough to have her gone.
So sorry, Scott. One thing I can say, if this brings you any type of comfort, is, you know, doing what you're doing in Grace's name, it's saving so many people.
Yes.
And I think about this all the time for myself too. You know, I constantly play this over in my mind, like, what could I have done differently? I should have did this. I should have been more, you know, more forceful. I should have, you know, I wasn't quick enough or whatever. But I'm here today having this conversation with you because of what I went through. And you are having this conversation with thousands of other people, and so many people will hear Grace's story. And because of that, you are saving so many lives. And I think I am a strong believer in things happen the way that they should and for a reason. The world needs people like you. And yeah. I am so honored to be on this conversation with you tonight. I'm so happy that I was able to see what you've done. I mean, this is incredible. For people listening at home, I'm going to put Scott and Grace's website in the description below, because you have to see what he's done. The work that he has put in and the information that is there is incredible. Absolutely incredible.
Thank you. Yeah. We've got a couple other things happening, which are really neat. So we started a billboard campaign locally. So we have 13 billboards along the highway.
Wow.
That go through this med. So it calls out St. Elizabeth's Hospital with the meds. The second campaign calls out the DNR order. And then the third is the transition to turn your life over to the Lord before it's too late. And so that is a 64-week campaign we committed to. It's a little over 200,000. I mean, this is a big deal. Our whole estate was going to Grace to take care of her after Cindy and I died. And so, you know, my wife is on board with this. You know, it's just, we got to do everything that we can to get the word out. So, I mean, this campaign was too aggressive. Three companies own all the billboards along the main highway in our area. Two of them wouldn't even take us on because they said it's too aggressive.
And when are these due to be up?
They started February 14th. So the first round are all up. So all 13 are up right now. And then they'll go through a year from May. So it'll be 64 weeks total. And then we're doing we just set the date today. So this is, you're the first one live to hear this, is April 8th. We're doing a protest outside of St. Elizabeth's Hospital. And Dr. Artis has already agreed to fly into Appleton to participate in that. That's on April 8th. And Tom Renz may fly in. I'm working with his business manager. And if he can't, at least we think he'll be able to speak via Zoom. So, and then we got a couple other ones that have already committed. So it's exciting stuff. I mean, to do a protest. Yeah, I mean, to do a protest outside the hospital. This is huge.
That's incredible.
Yeah. I think I might be flying over there to join.
I am curious, is there legal action that you are taking against the hospital or the doctor or the nurse?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we learned a lot about legal. Right now, I haven't invested a lot of time in it because the goal is to get the message out first. But I invested enough time in it to get my arms around it. And as you've learned through my research, I have it all documented. So Grace was an adult. So Grace was 19. And in Wisconsin, there is a state statute that says, if you're going to sue under loss of companionship, which is typically how you sue, you can't be an adult. So we have no claim under loss of companionship. So then the next claim would be under medical malpractice. And in Wisconsin, the statutory limit for medical malpractice is $750,000. That's a pretty common limit, as I understand it. I talked with maybe the best medical malpractice attorney in the state. And he was referred to me by an attorney from a very large firm who is pretty savvy, and talked with him. And he said, Scott, even in slam dunks like this appears to be, we only have a 1 in 10 chance of winning. And he shared a case where a doctor sewed up a sponge in a patient and they lost. And I said, how could you possibly lose? And he said, we have 10 expert witnesses. They'll bring 100. And he said, you just can't beat them. So you look at, like Ascension isn't going to lose this case. They got $26 billion in the bank. So, I mean, we're doing research now, not we anymore. I mean, there's Tom Renz is thankfully put us in charge with some attorneys that are working on this. And so it could come to fruition that there's going to be a big national case out of this, which would be, I think that's what it deserves. And it would put a burden on the hospital that needs to be there just to get this changed. But here's what happened. So a $750,000 limit, we're not after any money. So I said to the attorney, he said, so with a 1 in 10 chance, he said, we can't afford to take the case on. So I said, what if we sign over our 2/3 to you? Because the state statute says that the attorney gets 1/3, the family gets 2/3. He said, the statute doesn't allow that either. So we would give him the whole 750, but the statute says you can't do that. So then there, from a practical perspective, there's not a case unless you're going to just throw, you know, 500,000 against a 1 in 10 chance. And, you know, it isn't about the chances, you know, God's behind it. We're going to win the case. I'm not worried about that, but the, it seems like this is a more positive way to steer the energy. We're going to wait on the research. So they've got all the records, or maybe all the records. We're going to find out. They're looking through them now. And I met with the attorney and the medical researcher last week. They seem to have a good grasp on what's going on. So it could be forthcoming, which that would be neat. The other opportunity is a criminal case. So I met with the Appleton Police Department, met with the lieutenant there. He had reviewed the information from the website. And I don't want to comment on his comment just because we're just not ready for that yet. But that's, yeah, so who knows?
God indeed is behind it for sure. And he is very powerful indeed. Yes.
I mean, justice is going to be done regardless of if it's through the legal system or God's system. You know, God, they took one of God's. Grace was one of God's and they took her. So in God's economy, it's a lot like our economy that way. For every choice, there's a consequence. And so, I mean, they took one of God's and there's going to be a consequence. It's God's job to implement the consequence.
Well, I can't reiterate enough how much you are impacting people and the world. And it's hard for us to see that, that the reach and the impact that Grace's story in life will have, we'll never know that reach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's been, sorry, go ahead, Scott.
Well, I agree 100%.
It's been such, like I said before, it's been such a pleasure to have you on with us. I hope that you achieve everything that you want to achieve with sharing Grace's story. I know you will. I'm so moved by you and everything that you've done, and you're inspiring me to do more with my mom's case as well, and putting ideas in my head. So thank you for that. And I know that Grace would be very proud of you. Yes. For what you're doing. And you are here for a reason. You have survived because you're here to share her story. And we are very thankful that you have come on here with us. And we support you and your journey with this. Again, I'm going to share in the description below Grace's website for those at home who want to look at this information, which is valuable information. And we want to ask you if there's any advice that you would leave with your listeners. Regarding the hospital system, how to handle things, anything at all. What would you say to people at home who are listening?
I think we covered the advice throughout the story. I would say a couple of things in closing, though. Number one is don't give any credit to me. I mean, anything that's happening with this is is because of God. So praise him. He's the one that's giving me the adrenaline to keep going. I mean, every day it's like, I can't believe I haven't worked this hard in 30 years. So how can this be? And he's giving me the strength, and it's wonderful. And then I would just say this one last thing about grace. As you were just talking about, grace would be proud. Grace called me earthly dad. So I have this little sign on my laptop here from Grace. It's written from Grace. It has a heart and a U with it. So love you, a U with an exclamation point, earthly dad. And my daughter, Jessica, as we started rolling with these interviews, she said to me, Dad, Grace is looking down on you and saying, way to go, earthly dad. That's what I think about when you say something like that. I mean, Grace is, she's quite a motivation to do this. And I'm humbled by the opportunity. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Scott. That was very beautiful.
Thank you.